89.3 FM. That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Kazim Ali. Kazim Ali is a poet, editor, novelist, and dancer. Kazim Ali is the author of Black Buffalo Woman, an introduction to the poetry and poetics of Lucille Clifton. How are you doing today?
Hi there, how are you? I'm doing well.
Well, we have a lot to talk about today. And I want to begin by asking you a question of something that I was looking at. When I think of Lucille Clifton, I'm thinking of writers along with Lucille Clifton who seem to be more important today than they were when they were living. And I would say Lucille Clifton, Audre Lorde, and June Jordan. Would you agree with me on that?
Well, Lucille Clifton was pretty important in her day as well. She started out as a children's book writer, actually. Her first national publication was in a children's magazine called Highlights for Children, and was a fiction, story for children. And she continued a very long storied career writing from very early reader type of children's books all the way through to middle grade. She never really wrote a YA per se for higher ages, but she has two middle grade books for 11 to 14 kind of middle school reader. Mm-hmm. She published probably about, I think, between 20 and 30 books. It was 1968 when she won the Discovery Award from the 92nd Street Y and came to national attention and published her first book of poetry with Random House, because a young, at that time, young Random House editor discovered her through her winning of the 92nd Street Y Discovery Prize. The young Random House editor, Toni Morrison, mm-hmm. wrote to her and said, "Do you have a book of poetry?" and was her editor for several of her books after that.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I was saying, I'm glad you gave us, because that's a good introduction to Lucille Clifton's career. But what I was thinking about was how many writers, many, especially coming out of Cave Canem, see Audre Lorde, Lucille Clifton, June Jordan, in a sort of spiritual manner. Like, you know, I would not be writing if it was not for these women.
Yeah, for sure. I was at the Furious Flower Conference, which is a wonderful conference that happens every 10 years, focusing on Black poetry. This year was globally, and it happens at James Madison University, run by Lauren Alline is the new director. Great, great poet and person. And so that ballroom each night, were you there this mm-hmm. year? You mm-hmm. were there. Yeah, of course, because we talked there. Each night, so there's panels and readings all day long, and then each night the whole conference would get together in the ballroom to listen to several, slate of poets. And do you remember the amount of times that people mentioned Lucille Clifton's name from the podium, saying how influential she had been? I mean, it was like she was the patron saint of that conference, basically. I mean, more times than any other poet was mentioned. Audre Lorde was mentioned a bunch of times because Alexis Pauline Gums was there and has mm-hmm. recently published a book about Lorde. But Clifton was, she was present in the room. It was kind of incredible to me. I personally, she's always been important to me, and I've known that she's important to other people. But I think that's the first time that I was in there must have been 600 people there. No, I mean, it was a huge crowd of people, and every time her name was mentioned, the whole room was not necessarily applauding, but right. vocally saying, calling.
And I left that ballroom and I went over to the book table and I saw your book.
Yeah. I told them not to buy. They had it under A for Ali, and I said, no, the book should be under in the C's for Clifton.
Right.
And they had to move the stack over.
Right. Well, I wanted you to read this poem by Lucille Clifton, "Won't You Celebrate With Me?" Because you mentioned in your book on Black Buffalo Woman that this is a poem that Lucille Clifton would always end the reading with. And when I think about that, I think about the poet who, you know, I spent a lot of time with, that was Sterling Brown. And Sterling Brown would always end his reading with strong men. And I feel sometimes that some poets have a signature poem. Would you consider this Lucille Clifton's signature poem, or just a poem that she happened to read at the end of a reading?
One of the things I love about her is how many poems she has that people sort of think of as their own signature poem, and memorize and recite. But this was a poem that certainly was important to her. And I don't know when it started happening. I know every single time I ever saw her read, which was, you know, I saw her many a time read in the 15 years that I knew her, I've saw her read probably 15 times. I don't know. And she ended with this poem every time. And when I was working in the archives for this book, she'd actually had a plan for a much bigger, more comprehensive new and selected poems that she eventually abandoned in favor of doing the kind of smaller selected poems that she ended up publishing. Mm-hmm. But that selected poems was probably 250 pages long, and it was not chronological. That was the interesting part. Mm. He was taking poems from the books, but she reordered them. But that poem was still the last poem in the book. Mm.
Let's read this poem for us, Kazim Ali, and then we'll have a discussion of it, okay?
Yeah. So this is, "Won't You Celebrate With Me?" Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
Thank you, Kazim Ali, reading Lucille Clifton's poem, "Won't You Celebrate With Me?" Let's walk us through this poem. And this has a lot to do with the importance of your book, you know, Black Buffalo Woman, because you're not just looking at content, you're looking at structure. So talk to me about, and keep in mind, this is radio, and people people can't see the poem on the page. But take us through something. And first I'll mention a question about her use of punctuation.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, line breaks.
Yeah.
And then also specific to terms, the use of Babylon. And then also what she means between starshine and clay. And I'll go back to it, but let's begin with the punctuation and...
Well, those are really good questions. I mean, first of all, I have to say, around the mid 70s, at some point in the mid 70s, Lucille Clifton stopped using normative punctuation in her work. You'll see in her first two books an regular use of traditional upper and lowercase capitalization. She stops that and starts using only lowercase, including for the beginning of sentences, including for the personal pronoun I, including for the word God. She very, very rarely uses a capital. There's probably like four instances in her entire career that she uses capital letter. Three of them are in one single poem that came out in her first book. Other than that, she mostly does lowercase. And she stopped mostly using punctuation other than a comma and a period. So she rarely... I think never used an exclamation point or a question mark.
Well, let me ask you this as a critic.
Without the question mark. Yeah. But in this poem, you will see there are two questions at the beginning of the poem. And she uses there's two question marks in this poem.
Mm. Well, let me ask you this question before we go focusing on the punctuation. You know, some people, when they were using it, they wanted to de-emphasize the presence. And so instead of a capital I, it would be a lowercase I.
Yes, right? He does that here too.
And would you say that's the reason to say, okay, I'm just an ordinary woman and I don't want to emphasize? You know? I mean, I'm looking at sometimes because it was a political way that people were saying, okay, I'm using lowercase. I'm not giving credit to, you know, E.E. Cummings, but, you know, I'm using this because of how I see myself in the community of writers.
Yeah, I think that, you know, a big part of it was certainly that, I think. probably like an, I guess you would say an ethical reason right. to have lowercase I, but also there was a, the visual as well. She also stopped. So she had a single children's book that came out in, when did it come out? 1974, I think. And it called All Us Come Cross the Water. It's a very famous book of hers. And it was in a font that was very popular among children's books at the time. There was a particular editor that she worked with that many of the other writers were working with. And a lot of those books are in this font. It's called Optima. Mm-hmm. When Lucille Clifton, not for her next book, which was called The Two-Headed Woman, that came out in 1980, but her when she started publishing with Boa Editions, suddenly all of her poems are published in this particular font. It's so recognizable to readers of Lucille Clifton that they will call it the Lucille Clifton font. Mm-hmm. It's a very particular, distinctive font that is very spare and very atypically for poetry, but for any books, it's a sans serif font. That's not typical for any book publication. It's normally used for catalogs, public signage, all of that kind of stuff. You're seeing sans serif, right? Like a stop sign on the street. Right. It's the letters are. And the reason why is because it's so like attention grabbing. And that's the reason why it's typically not used for book publication. You will see some books now in it. Publishers are maybe trying to be distinctive or something like that. Rachel Cusk's novels, for example, are mostly in sans serif. But to have a poetry in sans serif at that time was extremely unusual. And I think what Lucille Clifton was really doing was there was a sense of visual attention to the spareness or the starkness.
Okay, let's go from the typography and go into the line breaks. Yeah. And also her use of the term Babylon and also starshine and clay.
Yeah. Well, the line breaks here are, they're not on the phrase, right? Won't you celebrate with me? Okay, that's one line. But the next line is what I have shaped into. And then a kind of life with question mark. It's not just a life, what I have shaped into a life. She does say what I've shaped into a kind of life. And then the phrase, I had no model. Mm-hmm. So she
period.
But then after that, so you have line breaks that are like that are kind of broken in the middle, but then you have others that are the full phrase. She never settles on one mode throughout this poem. So it has a propulsive type of quality and it kind of keeps you on your toes, keeps you moving kind of quality. This phrase, born in Babylon, is on its own line. Both non-white and woman is on its own line. What did I see to be except myself? The second question is on its own line. Mm-hmm. So you've had this opening three lines that are very enjambed, and then you have three, four, five, six, all the way to starshine and clay. Every single line is a phrase on its own line. Then it starts breaking again. My one hand holding tight, the line break is there. My other hand is on the next. Come celebrate, it's a line break. Then with me is the beginning. So mm-hmm. she goes back at the end of the poem to that. It's framed, in other words.
Right.
Yeah. The phrase starshine and clay, I want to talk about this because, first of all, yes, she's doing a metaphor for birth and death, right?
Mm-hmm.
That human beings are made, all matter on the planet is made of the matter from some exploded star somewhere, right? In the distant past. And then the notion of clay returning to clay.
Mm-hmm.
But there's two nuances to the line. First of all, clay in the Quran, and I think in the Bible too, I'm not sure, but clay is what God makes Adam from. He makes him from clay. And this is the reason in the Quran anyways, this is the reason why Iblis, which is Lucifer's name in the Quran, refuses to bow to Adam because he says, mm-hmm. I made fire and you made that from this rude material and you want me to bow to that. It doesn't make sense, you know? So she's sort of with clay, starshine and clay is a metaphor for birth and death.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, clay is also in scripturally a metaphor for birth. So starshine and clay is two forms of birth. Starshine sounds more mystical
right.
and clay sounds more physical and real, except mm-hmm. their origins Clay is the mythical origin for the human because it's from the scripture, while starshine is that is the physically, scientifically accurate description of our origin. So it's a mysterious little phrase that kind of echoes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm glad you said that because I want to go and mention something, cite something that you mentioned at the end of your book. At the end of your book, you mentioned how you believe Lucille Clifton was one of the greatest poets of the 20th century, 20th and 21st centuries, and one of the greatest in the English language. You mentioned how she is equal to Dickinson or Auden or Whitman or Brooks. Now, my question to you, Kazim Ali, did you reach this conclusion after you wrote your book, or was this the reason for writing your book?
You know, I always loved her. I loved her a lot, and I always been reading her for, you know, 35 years at this point, you know, because I read her for the first time in 1990 in school. So I always liked her, but I am a poet and a scholar of literature. So I read, you know, a lot of poetry, and I'm always nervous about saying someone is the best or someone is one of the best. I mean, it's a weird thing to say, right? Because we all read so much, we know so many people. You can't really say, like, is Brooks better than Lord? Is Lord better than Sanchez? Mm. We don't know the answer to these questions, you know? Partially, they're weird questions. And maybe they might be interesting, you know, as a conversation, but they're not interesting questions to answer, to solve. But when I really did this deep dive into her work, reading so much, talking about it, tracing the lineages, trying to explain the poetic techniques, I really think what I can say is I think about her the way I know smart people that I know think about Dickinson or think about Whitman.
Well, let me ask you this question on top of this, because it's very important. You're mentioning Dickinson, you're mentioning Whitman, and you could probably put some other great writers in there. But when I look at these writers also tell us something about who we are, as say, as Americans, who we are as a Western society. And so you seem like you've elevated Lucille Clifton. So my question is, what do I extract from the work of Lucille Clifton that is similar to, say, Dickinson and Whitman?
Yes, she on every level. I mean, formally as a poet, technique-wise, philosophically, the type of problems that she's engaging with, you know, why are humans here? What are we doing? What do we owe each other? What's the responsibility of a society, of leaders to their society? I mean, any question you can think of in the world. You want to think about what's happening right now in this country with this change in government that we've had? Go read From the Book of David, from her book, Terrible Stories. You want to learn about...
Oh, no, we can just go back to the poem that you... you know, we can just go back to the poem you opened up with. Something has tried to kill me and has failed.
She's a great writer, period. But she is 100% certainly a great American writer. I mean, she should be on a postage
stamp. Okay, let's go to her book before we get to postage stamp. Let's go to your book, right? Black Buffalo Woman.
Let me say one more thing before you celebrate with me. Only because we were talking about lineages, is that this poem is in the lineage of a sonnet. It is a 14-line poem. It has a turn in it. So it doesn't sound like a sonnet when one reads it, but it has the form of a sonnet behind it. And there's a scholar of romantic poetry named Omar Miranda who actually talks about Clifton referencing John Keats's sonnet on sitting down to read King Lear once again. And his essay tracks that poem as an ancestor for this poem, including that phrase that you mentioned between Starshine and Clay. Keats's poem has the phrase betwixt damnation and impassioned clay. So Keats is talking about the difference between hell and earth, and she's talking about the difference between earth and heaven. So she actually is traveling off of Keats's sonnet into her own.
I'm glad you provided that, because that leads back into the question I'm going to ask you. Your book, Black Buffalo Woman, is an outgrowth of four lectures that you gave for the Community of Writers in 2022. Take us back. How did you prepare for these lectures, and what did you want to examine? Because we have the book, but these started out as lectures. Yeah. And if I invited you to come give a lecture, you must have said, okay, these are things I was thinking about. I'm going to bounce these ideas off. And then I'm assuming a lot of it has to do with who you are addressing, who your audience is.
Yes, that was a wonderful opportunity, first of all, because the community of writers was a really important organization to Lucille Clifton herself. It's an annual meeting that happens every summer in the California mountains outside Tahoe in the Olympic Valley. And it's very different from, it sort of started as a kind of West Coast answer to Breadloaf because it was, you know, not so easy. It's not easy to travel now for some people either, but at the time there was a thought that, well, this huge Breadloaf thing happens in Vermont mountains every year. We've got mountains too, let's do it here. Right. There were a bunch of writers. Oakley Hall was a writer of Western and literary Western novels. Galway Kinnell was part of these conversations. There were a bunch of, Robert Haas, there were a bunch of writers who got together and said, let's do this. And it's different from Breadloaf and from any other conference because they come together for a week, but they're not doing workshops and panels. They're actually writing and then coming together each morning and sharing what they've, everyone's sharing, you know. So Lucille Clifton went every year, and a number of the poems from her books are poems, including Jasper, famous poem called Jasper, Texas, which was in her book, Blessing the Boats, I think it was in. Was written there. I was actually sitting next to her when she read that poem out loud for the first time. So this was a hugely important conference for her. They invited me, and that's where I met her. I met Lucille Clifton at this conference in 1998, summer of 98. So the Community of Writers is still going strong. It's directed by Brett Hall Jones, who is Oakley Hall's daughter, and you know, is like legacy of the Hall family, is continuing to run this conference. And they said, it was during the pandemic, you know, Zoom times and such. They said, we're doing these online classes, do you want to do one? And I said, sure, I'll do one on Lucille Clifton. And I had given a craft talk on her. And Brett said, why don't you do a four-part class? And I thought, four parts? Four classes, 2 hours a piece, that's 8 hours. That is a lot of time. I do not know if I have the material. But let me tell you something. I think it was really... I had published a couple of things about Lucille Clifton here and there over the years. I published an essay on the Buffalo War poems, which were the poems about the race riots in Buffalo, New York in 1967. And I published an essay on her poem Brothers, which is about Lucifer and God, that appeared in the Book of Light. But it was really new. And I started to write down all the poems I wanted to talk about. And I kind of divided those up into four kind of rough categories. And mm-hmm. then I'm going to tell you something that I haven't told anybody before. You're getting a scoop, which is I did not have lecture notes. I knew I just wanted to talk about Lucille Clifton, and I wanted to talk about her from the heart and wanted to cover as much as I had. What I actually did is I had a notebook in front of me and was taking notes as I talked. Yeah. I was thinking like, okay, like, this is good. Let me get this down. Yeah, so they were just delivered off of my Love and Engagement. For Lucille Clifton. I mean, I have been teaching at the college level now for, it was 22 years. So I'd been teaching at the college level at that point for 25 years already. So I know a little bit about how to give a lecture. It wasn't as if I was just standing up cold.
Well, how do you take these lectures now and turn it into a book?
Well, that was the interesting part. After it was over, I thought maybe I have a short book. And I had the lectures transcribed. I didn't do it myself. I paid one of the graduate assistants to transcribe. And I sat down with this stuff, and it was probably about 35,000 words. And I thought, well, I can expand this out, flesh it out a little bit, mm-hmm. and turn it into a big book. Well, the problem is that spoken language sounds very intelligent while you're talking. And when you're listening to someone, it probably sounds like the person you're listening to is very intelligent. But when you actually read the transcript, you know, we don't talk the way we speak mostly. And so I did have to actually rewrite from page one. Mm-hmm. I had it next to me and I was just typing, like writing it into written English, basically. But I started expanding as I went. And actually the four chapters turned into eight chapters for each individual mm-hmm. lecture. It ended up expanding into two chapters because I thought there were more poems I want to talk about, etc. And then in the end, I wrote two new chapters just for the book.
Hmm. Well, let me emphasize what I think, especially to our audience, why your book, Kazim Ali, is so important, not just for Lucille Clifton, but what you're doing in terms of for literary criticism. You know, you mentioned in the introduction of your book that Many people would praise the feeling in Clifton's work to the point of overlooking her craft and skill. And you focused more on, and then people would focus more on content than structure. And I was wondering, might that be a failure of our educational training, how we're taught to read poetry, that everybody wants to feel it first and not really want to look at it in terms of analyzing it critically?
It might be. And I think that, you know, that is the way that most people encounter poetry. There is such a thing as developing an ear, though. I mean, when you listen to a lot of, I will use rap music as an example, because I think this is the form of poetry that's probably even more than spoken word poetry. Recorded rap music is probably the way most people encounter what we all think of as poetry. And you don't really need to know formal prosody or be trained in any way to appreciate the way someone like Eminem or Mary Kay Blige or anybody uses language in creating rhythms. Once you listen to a lot of it, you'll hear something and think, oh, that was amazing. You might not know how it was built, but you can still appreciate it. So I get that. I don't think everyone has to have formal training. But if you do have formal training and you look at the structure of the sonnet or the iambic lines versus the trochaic lines, which Lucille Clifton does a lot. She switches meters within one single poem. It's one of her tricks. She does it all the time. If you know the rhythms, then you can really start to appreciate how the poem was made, how the poem was built. So I think that, you know, I'm hoping that people do more of that kind of formal analysis, not as a way of proving. I mean, it's not interesting to me. Mm-hmm. The fact that Lucille Clifton was riffing off of a Keats sonnet is not interesting politically to show that, well, she's in this lineage of Anglo phone poetry. She's quoting from the master. Like, that's not why. The reason why is to kind of see, like, oh, and here's how she built the poem. And like the fact that she is in this lineage of Keats is, when I said the part about Keats is moving from damnation to impassioned clay, he's moving from hell into life, and she's moving from starshine into clay, from life into death. That's why it's interesting, because you understand more about what she's doing when mm-hmm. you see that she's riffing off of John Keats. It's not interesting because Clifton is riffing off of Keats, it's legitimizing her importance as a poet. That's not why it's interesting.
Well, I saw you doing something interesting, is that I was reading your book, and then I came to a commercial on page 199, and the commercial was, oh, if you want to get a better understanding of my book, these are the books of poetry that you should read, like Annie Fitch. You know, there are people's books that conservatives can be like, if you've been reading so far, maybe you got a little lost, here's a raft that you can use to get through the rest of the book. Yeah. And I say that on a serious note, because I felt that the beauty of your book was that I didn't see it necessarily being for the general reader, but for somebody who really is saying, okay, I want to be a writer. I want to teach writing. I love it. And you're taking friends, like, for example, this is not a first date. This is a relationship.
Yeah. Well, I want someone who's never read any poetry at all, even Lucille Clifton, to be able to pick this book up and get something out of it, mm-hmm. certainly. But I was aware that there was, and this is also, I mean, that is why it's called, the subtitle is An Introduction. Right. I did not want to try to write a comprehensive book. There is no way of doing that. I mean, her collected poems is 700 plus pages. And then there's all of this, the children's writing and like all of this other
material. But Kazeem, I want to emphasize something. Even though you're saying it's an introduction to Lucille Clifton, if I pick up your book, you're introducing me to a way I should look at poetry in general, not just Lucille Clifton.
I appreciate that so much. I really like, thank you for saying that. It is my way of looking at poetry. And I feel like every time you read a book of literary criticism, you're also learning about how that writer looks at literature itself. There's this book, actually really dislike it, this book. I dislike this book's argument. It's a book by Joan Acocella, who's a great writer. And it's a book about Willa Cather. It's called Willa Cather and the Politics of Criticism. I disagree with Joan Acocella's argument in this book. And when I'm reading it, I think, like, how could you be so wrong? But I love the book and I reread it. I'm not lying to you. I reread it every single year because I love the way she makes her argument. And I love the attention she gives to Cather. And I love how she's thinking about Cather. I don't agree with what she's thinking about Cather, but I like how she does it. So I think that a really, really good book of literary criticism does that. For me. So for you to say that about this book, I feel like that's great. That's
okay.
I will take that as very high praise.
All right. Well, let's move into something which I also saw that you mentioned, and I thought it was very, very important. And I'm thinking of how specifically African-American women are viewed. Okay. And I'm thinking of someone, I'm thinking definitely of June Jordan. I'm thinking of bell hooks. I'm thinking of how you say Lucille Clifton is a thinker and philosopher. Mm-hmm. You know, like I remember there were, when Toni Morrison was very popular, I think she was on the cover of Newsweek, and it was, it's like Toni Morrison was black magic. Like she just put stuff in a pot and came up with characters, you know, they didn't take anything about craft. But and we weren't looking at her as a thinker. Okay. Yeah. You know, and I'm wondering in terms of when we look at Lucille Clifton, and we're now looking at her as a thinker and a philosopher. And I want to look at separate those two, because when I recently interviewed Percival Everett, okay, he's very popular. Yeah. You know, I was talking about the philosophical novel, because Percival Everett is trained in philosophy. Charles Johnson, you know, Middle Passage, is also trained in philosophy. There's a young writer, Erica Hughes, she's in a PhD program in philosophy. So if I now I'm a philosopher, and I now look at your book, and you're saying we have to look at Lucille Clifton as a philosopher, who are we comparing her to in terms of philosophers?
I mean, it's a really good question. When I say that she is a philosopher, I don't necessarily think I don't necessarily.
Well, hold on 1 second. We got to take a little break because we got to take a little break. I see, Mike. Then we'll get back to the big question. I'm talking to Kazim Ali. He's the author of Black Buffalo Woman, An Introduction to the Poetry and Poetics of Lucille Clifton. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethan Miller, and the station is WPSW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of March 17, 2025. On Thursday, March 20th, the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, invites you to the talk and book signing for Global Battlefields with author and legendary public intellectual from the Global South, Walden Bellow. The first session in the series, Lessons from Resistance to Authoritarianism Around the World, 12:30 to 2 p.m. at IPS, 1301 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest, D.C. You can find more info and register on ips-dc.org/events. On Friday, March 21st, a book discussion, Dismantling the Master's Clock, with Rashida Phillips. She will delve into time, racial justice, and quantum physics, and will take place from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info can be found on sankofa.com. On Saturday, March 22nd, from 6:30 to 9 p.m., there will be Community Iftar, a fundraiser for Gaza. Enjoy food at Balkis Restaurant at 5820 Seminary Road, Unit J in Falls Church, Virginia. More info can be found on their social media at DMVPYM. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. To see more info and all events, go to wpfw.org under the Events tab. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with Kazim Ali. I got so caught up in the conversation, I forgot about the break. But we were talking before we had our break. We were talking about, you know, Lucille Clifton as a philosopher and thinker. Talk about that, Kazim.
Yeah, I really think about when I was reading her across her whole body of work. I was writing the chapter on religious and spiritual. And first of all, it suffuses almost everything she writes. So it's hard to separate out a poem and say, like, we're going to talk about in this context versus that context. But certainly there were a series of poems in a section called Some Jesus from her second book, Good News About the Earth, that dealt directly with biblical figures. Then she had another sequence in the next book about Mary, which were written, and they were both written in separate kind of different kinds of African-American vernacular. The poems from Good News About the Earth were written in kind of more of a Southern Black American dialect, whereas the Mary poems from the later book were written in more of a Caribbean dialect. So she is really, really exploring language. We didn't get even talk about that yet. Mm-hmm. But then she continued throughout her career. So she has, I mentioned those poems about Lucifer and God. She has a very famous sequence called The Tree of Life in her book Clifton, which is a quilting, which is Adam and Eve in the garden. And then Lucifer's also there hiding, but he doesn't speak until the final poem, which I think is really interesting. And then the Book of David, where she writes about King David. So she's really, really engaging with this throughout. And throughout these poems, she's also interrogating the differences between the human and the divine. So her husband, Fred Clifton, who passed away prematurely, as she writes about in her work, was a philosopher. He studied philosophy at the University mm-hmm. of Buffalo and was a yogi and was what we call a Advaita Vedanta, non-dualist philosophy where there's no distinction between the human and the divine. Whereas in the Christian tradition and the biblical tradition, there are humans and there's God. And so Lucille Clifton, throughout all of these poems from beginning to end, kind of explores and interrogates and troubles these distinctions and really kind of becomes a philosopher of religion in her own way. And her final sequence of poems, which was not published while she was alive, but that Kevin Young and Michael Glazer, who edited the collected poems, found in a printout. It was printed out and stapled together, so they knew that it was meant to be a sequence. One can tell it's meant to be a sequence because it has recurring figures. It's called the Book of Days, mm-hmm. and they date it to 2006, which was actually before her final book came out. So she made a conscious decision when she was crafting her last, when she crafted her book, she was very careful. In her archives, there are numbers of poems that are not included in the books because she was shaping them very intentionally. But this sequence of 30 pages, the Book of Days, goes back to the Garden of Eden, the prodigal son, Adam and Eve, like all of those figures return in this sequence that she ultimately decided not to include in that last book.
Well, let's talk about another sequence of poems. Let's talk about another sequence of poems that I'd like you to comment on. And that is the 10 ox herding pictures, because I see there, you know, her move, her interest in Buddhism. Talk about that.
Well, okay, so those poems are another set of poems that she wrote much earlier. She wrote them in 1987 or 86 or 87, but did not include them in a book until 2008. So it's almost 20 years later that she finally put them into a book. They're based on a series of classical, I guess you would say, Zen teaching poems. Mm-hmm. And they are pictures, and they're different. There's no canonical pictures, but there's a 15th century monk who created the set of pictures, and then other people have done the ox herding pictures. And then there's a poem, a kind of classical poem that goes along with each picture. Lucille Clifton claimed to have written hers only knowing the titles of the poems. She hadn't read the poems themselves, nor had she actually seen the pictures. So what I do in the book is I go through the 10 poems and analyze each poem as it relates to the original poem and the original picture, and kind of talk about the way Lucille Clifton is approaching Buddhism. And what's fantastic, there are some differences where she kind of diverges off of the traditional text in interesting ways. But what's most compelling is that by the end of these 10 poems, without knowing anything about Zen Buddhism before she wrote these, she knew lots about yoga and Vedanta philosophy through Fred Clifton and her own engagement with it, but she did not know a lot about Buddhism and Zen Buddhism by the time she wrote these poems in the mid-80s, but she kind of arrives at it through the writing process. So I find those poems really, really fascinating.
You know, I want you to, and this ties into a key part of writers, and you went to her archives at the Rose Library at Emory University. I was wondering if we go back and look at her work, especially in our archives, let's say, how does Lucille deal with revision? Are there poems where we find several copies of the same poem and you can see how she's been revising it?
Oh, yeah. So many. There's so many different ones. And it's what's really interesting is you can watch her do both moves. Like sometimes she writes like a longer poem and then she pares it down and cuts things out. But other times she'll write a poem of like maybe just five phrases and then she eventually builds it out into what it is. So she's
probably... Let me ask you this, because you know, this is how things have changed. Because sometimes we're doing with like computers and parts, we don't see a writer like crossing out words, you know, so I could actually, I could look at a page and I can say, okay, someone did the revision of this, and I can see, you know, like Walt Whitman, you can see all the changes, the leaves of grass. Yeah. Does Lucille change? I mean, did she save her material? Do you see it that closely where things go crossed out on the pages?
Yeah, you know, she, so a lot of, some of the stuff is handwritten and, mm-hmm. but mostly it's not, mostly it's typed. Or on a computer. And so what I actually did find was occasionally I would find handwritten comments on the typed versions themselves, or a rewritten version on the typed version itself. So that was really interesting to me. Do you want to hear?
Now here comes a difficult question. Now I want to ask you a difficult question.
Yeah.
Are you ready for the difficult question?
Yeah, and then I want
okay.
to
okay, the difficult
ask you a question now.
Okay, what I want to know is, one, how had Lucille Clifton matured as a writer? And then you, moving away from being a person praising her, being a critic, are there things that you say, okay, this floor is here. She's not perfect. She's, you know, this is an ordinary line by an ordinary woman. I mean, I'm saying that because sometimes a person is so close to an author, you know, that they're not willing to be critical. You know, it's like, if I was interviewing Alice Walker, I said, did Zora Neale Hurston ever write a bad book? She might say no.
there are definitely moments where I talk about, for example, Lucille Clifton wrote a lot about Black life. And she also wrote a lot about, at the time in the 70s, the political consciousness, and 80s, as she was working on Indigenous issues. It was in the news, but we did not have as fine a nuanced understanding of a lot of it. So she was writing about Indigenous life also, but with not as subtle a brush as she was writing about her own community. So she was more relying on she wrote about mythological figures in the Black community, but she also wrote about individual people. And when she writes about Indigenous life, she's more broadly, more general. She writes a bunch of poems about an Indigenous leader, Toshinka Witko, AKA quote unquote Crazy Horse, as he was called. Mm-hmm. And so I did talk about that, but I also said that understanding the subtlety with which she approached all of her subjects, I would assume that as we as a society have gained a greater engagement and understanding of indigenous life and history and the political situation, the granular details of it, I'm sure that her own approach would have become more sophisticated as she went along too. Mm. I mean, it was plenty sophisticated.
You're going to make a
very different compared to writing about the rest of the things. Yeah.
You were going to make a point.
I want to ask you a question because you asked me about revision. I wanted to ask you if you could read one of the original versions and then the version. Actually, what I would do it in reverse because I think it's really interesting. I'd read you the published version and then read you the first draft of the poem.
No, let's not do that because I got some questions I want to ask you. We're going to run out of time.
Right.
But I want to ask you, I want to ask you about Lucille Clifton in terms of, and you mentioned a few of it. Many people come to the poet. She's a very important children's writer. And I mean, but I'm assuming that some of those books seem to be difficult to find.
They are. There's a couple of reasons. So a lot of them are written in what we would call Black English. I think the formal term is African-American vernacular English. And I don't know, what do you think? My sense is maybe that's not I don't want to use the term politically correct, but will we see a lot of children's books written in that particular form of English these days. Even at the time, it was controversial when she published her first children's book that was written, All Us Come Across the Water, was written in this form of English.
Well, you know, the two other women writers that were really addressing that issue was June Jordan and Carolyn Rogers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And there was a lot of pushback on that.
A lot of pushback. And so June Jordan probably has written the most extensively in terms of her critical writing to write about Nobody Mean More to Me Than You or The Future Life of Willie Jordan, where she really talks about Black English as a language, the grammatical rules of it, how one speaks it, how one writes it, all of that. Lucille Clifton didn't do that kind of work. So I recommend that essay to anyone who wants to learn more about the language as itself. And then there's a scholar named William Fogarty who wrote a book about language, diction and language, including Seamus Heaney, Derek Walcott, and Lucille Clifton. And he talks about extensively in a beautiful chapter about her use of Black English. So I think perhaps, I don't know, it's my theory that might be... Lucille Clifton was criticized at the time by Black critics for, you know, was considered denigrating, you know, to use this, you know, that it was not doing a service to Black children to read books that were written in a like incorrect English, you know. So I'm wondering now how those books might, if that's the reason. I don't know. Some of them are. Still, but the Black BCs, for example, which is a classic, you know, you're going to spend $500 to get a copy of that, you know, because it's not correct anymore. But they are beautiful books.
Let me ask you, as we get to the end of our show, two other things that to talk about. Humor, you know, I always felt that in readings, and sometimes I always think of writers who, in between their poems, they were just very funny. And then it's something that carried over to work. And two, I think of Sterling Brown, I think of Mary Baraka, you know, they were very humorous in terms of in between poems. I always felt that you see Clifton had that sort of like laid back sort of humor that she would comment. Talk about how that in terms of reading and also that you see in her work.
Yeah, she was definitely... I think knowing that she was a children's writer first makes a little bit of sense, because there is a quality of the didactic in all of her work where she is really, really trying to communicate with a person. She's no modernist writing like a very like opaque, abstract kind of poem. She's really engaging. Even that "Won't You Celebrate With Me," she's addressing the reader directly, not a theoretical reader, but every person in her audience. "Won't you celebrate with me?" And I think her use of humor is like that. It's probably more evident in the earlier books. She has a little bit of a turn with her book, The Terrible Stories, where she is writing about her cancer and her dialysis. And she writes about, you know, starts to write about the fragility of health, you know, once her husband died in 1983 or four, forget the exact date right now. And so there's a little bit of a shift in her work towards a more somber tone in those later books. But the earlier books are full of very witty, very funny, very engaging kind of...
How did that connect to her also use of, and I think of, right, I'm thinking of Tim Siebel does this a lot, popular culture?
Yeah, I actually have a whole chapter in the book about popular culture. She writes about Lois Lane and Kent. She writes about the Phantom, who's an old... comic book figure. She writes a poem about Lorena Bobbitt in her book, The Terrible Stories. You don't know who Lorena Bobbitt is, that'll date you.
You're right.
Someone is if they know who she is. She was always very, very engaged. And even in the earlier poems, she's writing, you know, this is like in the late 60s, early 70s, and she's writing poems about Bobby Seale. She wrote a poem about Malcolm X, Little Richard, Angela Davis, you know, she's writing about the current, you know, Marvin Gaye. She's writing about like what's happening right now in life.
So. You know, when I think, because you know, we're coming to the end of the show. When I think of Lucille Clifton, the first thing I think about in terms of her work, I think about Lucille Clifton and the Black female body. you know, and I'm not just dealing with her poems about her hips, harmonizing her hips. I'm thinking about how she's dealing with cancer. She's dealing, you know, she's seeing the physical body dealing with health issues, but then she's also celebrating the Black body. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. She has a poem called Dialysis, which is in her book. It's either in Blessing the Boats or Terrible Stories, I forget right now, but she really writes about how her body is like after cancer, after all of that, now this, you know? And the last line of the poem is, blessed be even this. But it ends with a question mark. It doesn't end with a period. And so she herself talked in an interview how a reader of her work might have expected that sentence, blessed be even this, to end with a period, accepting, you know, everything that comes. But instead, it ends with a question because she's still asking, like, who is the God? This was the central question of her poem, Brothers, which was the dialogue between Lucifer and God that appeared in the Book of Light. The central question was, who is a God that would allow the scale of human suffering? Who is the God that would allow the murder of children? You know, that is the ancient philosophical question. Somebody like 5,000 years ago on the plains of Iraq was asking that very question, right? Like, can there be a God, but who would let this happen, basically? She is still asking that question over and over again, even to the end of her life. She never answers the question.
Talk about the Clifton House in Baltimore.
Well, this is a wonderful thing. Sidney Clifton, so Lucille had 6 children, right? 2 of them predeceased her, as she writes about in her work. But the 3 daughters, Sydney, Gillian, and Alexia, and then her son, Graham, Sydney bought the chat. So Lucille Clifton and Fred Clifton moved from Buffalo, New York to Baltimore. They lived in a big, beautiful house outside Baltimore on a street called Talbot Avenue, I think. And the girls all grew up in that house. And famously, as Fred was sick and the healthcare costs were mounting, they were bank foreclosed on the house. I'm not sure the details of when that happened and how, and Lucille Clifton accepted a job offer. I don't know if Nate Mackey was involved in this, if he was there yet, but UC Santa Cruz brought her out, and she went out to UC Santa Cruz, and that's how she supported her family for many years, teaching there. And many, many, many years later, Sidney Clifton, you know, woke up from a dream, basically, dreaming of the house. It may or may not have been the anniversary of Lucille Clifton's death. I forget the exact details of the story. And she reached out, and the current owners of that, through the agent or however this happened, the current owners of the house said, yeah, we just decided to sell. We're putting it on the market tomorrow. And Sidney said, well, don't put it on the market just yet. Let's talk about this. And she bought the house. She's refurbishing it. It's been redone beautifully. They're turning it in. It is a literary center. There are workshops that happen there, readings. They're turning it into writing residency eventually. I stayed in the house myself. I know Salise Germain was there in the house. And we're in Lucille Clifton's bedroom, you know, visiting writers are sleeping. And
okay, so we're going to end on that. No, if people are sleeping in
the house. It's so magical. You know, you get all that
okay.
Energy.
Okay. Yeah. We've got to come to the end of the show, Kazim Ali. Well, you know, we've honored the woman with the 12 fingers, you know, today. And so I'm very happy that you were able to be my guest. I have a lot of admiration and respect for you. My guest today has been Kazim Ali. He's the author of Black Buffalo Woman, An Introduction to the Poetry and Poetics of Lucille Clifton. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM. We'll be right back.
get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Jazz lovers, the 15th Annual Washington Women in Jazz Festival is back with a weekend of performances, workshops, and jam sessions at the Penn Arts Mansion in Washington, D.C. on March 29th and 30th. From interactive workshops to concerts and late-night jams, there's something for everyone. Details at WashingtonWomenInJazz.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, and on April 6, noon until 7:30 p.m., Words, Beats, and Life kicks it off with the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam. Family-friendly activities, art activations, food truck vendors, and performances will all happen in Franklin Park. Details at wblinc.org/WBLFest.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. In detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country. In the words of Angela Davis, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you at night. Standing together as people of conscience and demanding Mahmoud Khalil's freedom, it is a stand against fascism, and it is a stand for our collective right to free speech and protest. I'm Dave Zirin. This has been a WPFW editorial.
How do you find peace and happiness amidst all the uncertainty around us? On March 20th, the International Day of Happiness, spiritual leader Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankar will be in conversation with author Arthur Brooks at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. for Unlocking Happiness. Practical tools to cultivate joy backed by science and timeless wisdom will be shared, including a live guided meditation by Gurudev. Details at aolf.me/UHDC.
Do you love captivating stories about our planet and the people who protect it? The DC Environmental Film Festival returns to theaters throughout the metro area March 20th through the 29th. This year's lineup boasts over 50 programs featuring films from all over the world about issues from environmental justice to wildlife conservation and our oceans. Details at dceff.org. That's dceff.org. Use your heart and not your
eyes.
African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora is featured at the 21st New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 14 to the 27th. The festival features 29 films from 19 countries, discussions with filmmakers, and more. The 2025 New African Film Festival features the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa. Tickets and